Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who's Wise made for? It's made for jet setters and slow travelers, for online marketplaces and real-life bazaars, for business in the city and pleasure on the coast. Wise is made for studying abroad and supporting your little brother's schooling back home. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
President Biden in Mexico City today pitches his proposed changes for asylum seekers at the border. Some analysts say it's a far cry from comprehensive immigration reform.
I would say baby steps.
Also today, the international community pledged $9 billion to help Pakistan recover from its devastating summer floods. Welcome relief, but the final price tag for recovery is estimated to be closer to $45
billion. So comparing $9 billion to that doesn't really seem like all that much.
I'm Marco Werman. And bullfighting in Colombia. Many there say it's barbaric and should be outlawed. Others say it's culture and art.
Digamos el futuro y muy cercano es que esto se va a eliminar.
In a crowd of 15,000 who attended a big bullfighting festival there, this man says we need to enjoy it while it lasts. Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it today. It is day two for President Biden in Mexico City, where he's taking part in the North American Leaders Summit. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador also in attendance. The Mexican leader had some sharp words for the American president. AMLO, as he's known, challenged Biden to end years of abandonment and disdain toward Latin America. Biden appeared to respond to the criticism with this.
You know, the United States provides more foreign aid than every other country just about combined in the world, not just the hemisphere, but around the world. Unfortunately, our responsibility just doesn't end in the Western Hemisphere.
From Washington's point of view, the big thing to tackle at the summit is what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border. The World's TV Saicea starts us off today with more on that.
Last year, close to 2.4 million people tried to cross into the U.S. from Mexico without permission. That's a record high.
Something you see all over Latin America right now is that people are fleeing. People can't live in their home countries.
Adam Isaacson is a security expert on Latin America. He says the pandemic has made life really difficult for people in the region.
And you're seeing a large number of people seeking protection. And there are key points along the way, both to other countries and to the United States, where people get stranded.
The Mexican side of the U.S. border is one of those places. U.S. immigration authorities say they don't have the capacity to process so many migrants, and that's why they've been turning them back to Mexico. Many of these people have been waiting for a chance to be admitted into the U.S. for years. And northern Mexico, Isaacson says, is a dangerous place to wait because of organized crime.
Which is, you know, extorting and assaulting, abusing, raping, kidnapping migrants in very large numbers, with almost zero cases of organized criminals ever being brought before the law and punished for abusing migrants.
On the U.S. side of the border, El Paso, for example, has seen so many arrivals, it's now using its convention center as an emergency shelter. Republicans have been pushing President Biden to visit the border and see what's going on there with his own eyes. In an interview with CNN more than a year ago, Biden said this.
Do you have plans to visit the southern border?
I've been there before, and I haven't. I mean, I know it well. I guess I should go down, but the whole point of it is I haven't had a whole hell of a lot of time to get down.
This week, President Biden went to the border for the first time during his presidency. Julia Gillard from the Migration Policy Institute says he waited this long because immigration has been such a politicized issue.
On the one hand, he's wanted to project that he's welcoming to immigrants. On the other hand, he's wanted to be really tough at the border because high numbers of border arrivals are difficult politically.
Gillard says Biden also didn't seem to have a concrete plan for the border until now. Just last week, he announced a new legal pathway for migrants coming from Nicaragua, Haiti, Cuba, and Venezuela. They make up a significant portion of the arrivals at the border. people from those countries will be allowed to apply for work permits in the U.S. if they pass a background check and find someone who can sponsor them. Biden also announced a new smartphone app for asylum seekers waiting in Mexico.
CBP1-ONE, to schedule an appointment at a port of entry and make their asylum claim there without crossing the border unlawfully.
But just how far does all of this go to finding a solution to the border crisis?
I would say baby steps.
Maureen Meyer is with the Washington office in Latin America. She says the new rules might reduce the number of migrants showing up at the border, but the asylum application process is still overwhelmed and needs to be fixed.
And that involves investing immigration judges, asylum officers, and the entire infrastructure for the immigration courts in the United States.
Right now, the average asylum seeker waits from 2 to 4 years for a court date. Julia Gillard says allowing more people to apply for asylum from their home countries would help, too.
So they can find that protection without having to make a dangerous journey across the continent.
To qualify for asylum in the U.S., people need to show a well-founded fear of prosecution. The reality is, most migrants applying for asylum at the border are not likely to qualify. And this represents a missed opportunity for the U.S. economy, says Giovanni Piero.
Because not only they come for a job, but also there is need of these people in some jobs.
Piero is at the University of California, Davis, where he studies the impact of immigration on the job market here.
So there are about 6 million jobs which cannot be filled even by local unemployed. These unfilled jobs are in restaurant service, assistance of people with health problems, assistance of the elderly. Those are jobs which don't require a college education.
But Piero says most of the migrants arriving at the southern border don't have an opportunity to get permission to work. Providing that, he says, would be a big step toward a long-term solution. But that will require an agreement in Congress, which has been elusive for many years. In the meantime, it will be up to Presidents Biden and López Obrador to find ways to address the border crisis. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea.
In Sao Paulo, Brazil, yesterday, the city's main thoroughfare was filled with pro-democracy demonstrators. They came out to voice their disgust with the violent attack on Brazil's capital over the weekend. Sem anistia, no amnesty. Those words were repeated in rallies across Brazil. People demanding punishment for supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro, those rioters who stormed the Capitol complex on Sunday. Newly sworn-in President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva called them fascist fanatics. He also accused Bolsonaro of encouraging the uprising. Bolsonaro denied that accusation. He also tweeted that peaceful protest is part of democracy, but that vandalism and invasion of public buildings crosses a line. Brazilian police have already rounded up roughly 1,500 people for participating in the rampage. It seems with each passing day, Israel's new right-wing government is making headlines. The latest follows some heavy criticism after proposed changes to the country's entire judicial system. The changes would weaken Israel's Supreme Court, potentially giving unchecked power to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new government. With us to explain is Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem. What exactly are these proposed changes to Israel's legal system, Noga, and who proposed them?
Justice Minister Yariv Levine proposed them. He's a very close ally of Benjamin Netanyahu. And it's basically an all-out assault that would dismantle Israel's judiciary. The Knesset, which is Israel's parliament, would have override ability. So a simple majority of the parliament could override any Supreme Court decisions. The government would become a majority in the committee choosing new judges at all levels of the judiciary, and legal counsel to all of the government's ministries would become basically private defense attorneys for each individual minister rather than an office of legal counsel to the ministry. It's just a complete overhaul.
And how much power would this potentially give to the prime minister's office, Netanyahu's office?
The current assessment of the jurists who I have spoken to is that it would give the government basically absolute power in the judicial realm. And I think it's important to mention that the justice minister said this is part one of his proposed reform as incredible as that may sound, he refuses to say what is part two. But the general assumption here in Israel is that he plans to cancel the crimes of fraud and breach of trust, which are two of three charges for which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is currently on trial.
An independent judiciary is a linchpin to any democracy. What's the likelihood that these proposals actually pass the Knesset?
That's an excellent question, and I think it may be the fundamental question in Israel today. Netanyahu has a majority of 64 out of 120 parliament members. So in theory, all of this could be passed into law pretty quickly. And here, it's being referred to as regime change, flat out. Israel would no longer be classified as a democracy. There would be no checks and balances. We're basically talking about absolute power for the executive. However, Netanyahu has very little public support for this. So a very solid majority of Israelis do not want this. Every single poll is showing this. There was a massive protest I attended last Saturday night in Tel Aviv of tens of thousands of people. An even bigger one is being planned for next Saturday night. The new police minister, who has a new name, he's the Minister for National Security, has already proposed bringing water cannons against peaceful protesters next Saturday night. One of that minister's allies has said that the head of all the opposition parties should be arrested for treason to the nation. So everything is very, very hot and volatile right now.
Mm. If the Knesset, though, as you say, could vote it through pretty quickly, given the makeup of the parliament, then I wonder what power does Israel's Supreme Court currently have to invalidate a law passed by the Knesset?
That is exactly the constitutional crisis that we are hurtling towards. And I can't emphasize enough, part of all of this judicial package has also involved proposals that are already being debated in Knesset committees to dismantle all of the systems in place so that, for example, this judicial package, instead of having to go through the normal system of committee debates, and then it would wait, I can't remember how long until it appears as an official law and so forth, that this particular set of laws would become law instantaneously upon being voted. So the system itself is being changed, even as the system itself is being under attack.
Yeah, constitutional crisis. That's not hyperbole. What do we know about how this would affect Arabs living in Israel or Palestinians in the occupied West Bank?
I think immediately it would affect all Israeli citizens, including Arab citizens, any minority, and not just minorities. For example, women who are a majority would become unprotected. The LGBTQ community here is extremely alarmed. Certainly for Arabs, this would be a problem. The Israeli government has already announced sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. There have been a number of punitive measures. The police minister, by decree, announced that flying the Palestinian flag from now on in Israel is not going to be permitted. So I think those are the areas where the United States might intervene first.
Finally, Noga, do we know whether the U.S. has raised concerns with Benjamin Netanyahu or Israel's government about these proposed changes?
The National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, is on his way to Israel in the coming days. I expect that he will bring it up, although it's very delicate because for now these are proposals. The U.S. Ambassador, Tom Nides, was interviewed today here in Israel, and he basically said that the United States and Israel have a set of shared values. Among them is democracy. And basically, you know, one way of hearing what he said was, you guys are going to have to figure this out.
Noga Tarnopolsky is an Israeli journalist speaking with us about Israel's rightward shift and proposed changes to its judiciary system. She joined us from Jerusalem. Noga, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Last summer, when Pakistan was devastated by floodwaters, experts said it would take billions of dollars to repair the damage. Now some of that funding has been promised, but it's only part of the solution. We hear why on the show just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The floods that devastated Pakistan last summer impacted some 33 million people. Yesterday, at a meeting in Geneva, international donors pledged more than $9 billion to help Pakistan recover and rebuild. Much of that aid was not just pledged in typical disaster relief fashion. The impacts of climate change are very much at the center of the discussion. Aisha Siddiqui has some ideas about the best way to help Pakistan. She teaches in the Department of Geography at the University of Cambridge and is the author of In the Wake of Disaster, a book about floods in Pakistan back in 2010. Aisha Siddiqui, when you heard about the more than $9 billion pledged to help Pakistan rebuild from the floods, what was your first thought about the number? Enough? A good start? Inadequate?
This is definitely just a starting point for what Pakistan needs in terms of recovery from the floods. But it's definitely not sufficient for what Pakistan needs in order to be able to recover from the scale of the disaster that was experienced in 2022. And just to say, currently the figure being quoted around in local media and press stories to save Pakistan from a Sri Lanka-style kind of default, really serious economic downturn is about $45 billion. So comparing $9 billion to that doesn't really seem like all that much.
So when we talk about this $9 billion, where is that money needed most? And if you look at the $45 billion, can you talk about that as well?
Where the $9 billion could potentially go at this point is on ensuring that the most vulnerable households have some kind of intervention with cash, with recovery. Because in previous floods, where Pakistan was able to implement quite strong kind of cash interventions, etc., these floods did not actually result in that large-scale social protection of the kind that was rolled out by the state in previous years. So identifying the most vulnerable households, for which there is a whole kind of poverty scorecard that already exists, and ensuring that those households are targeted, that they have some degree of safety built up in order to deal better with future situations like this.
You wrote your book, In the Wake of Disaster, about the 2010 floods in Pakistan. They were also devastating. What is your takeaway from that experience in terms of what's needed to recover and rebuild from floods?
In the case of the 2010-2011 floods, what Pakistan was able to do quite well was reach out to people in that kind of rescue and relief stage. So they implemented this large citizens damage compensation program, which ensured that people got cash transfers. They were able to do immediate kind of relief for people who were in the most affected areas. What they were less able to do is implement those kind of structural changes to ensure that these kinds of floods don't have this devastating impact again. And that's why 10 years later, Pakistan experienced something like this again. So what needs to be done is really to look at the structural issues. And one of the one that keeps coming up is the way that the Indus River is managed.
That's the important Indus tributary, yeah?
Yes, yes. And the way that the systems of river engineering, hydro management, etc., are currently operating is on a very, very engineering-based paradigm, which really doesn't allow for the natural ebbs and flows of the river and of the water that collects to be drained out. So because there is so much overdevelopment, over-engineering currently in the Indus River Basin, Pakistan regularly faces this problem where every few years, some amount of extreme rainfall turns into very devastating floods. And looking much more closely at how state planners can work with river systems, with local ecological systems, rather than coming with a very engineering focused, we must conquer the natural environment. That's an issue that a number of scholars in this field have been pointing towards.
As you know, there are also concerns about corruption and how the more than $9 billion will be used. The Pakistani government says it will have independent outside monitors to ensure the money goes where it needs to go. Does that reassure you?
I have a very clear stance on this. It is not for any other state to tell a sovereign country how to manage their finances. And in fact, we know this, there is some amount of work in academic research that has already taken place, which says that often corruption becomes this kind of bugbear for countries in the global north to keep beating over the heads of countries in the global south, saying you shouldn't get this money because you're just going to squander it. There's a particular patronizing kind of undertones to that kind of negative thinking. The fact of the matter is that when there were large-scale floods in 2010 and 2011, the money that came in was in fact distributed through a proper social registry that Pakistan has set up. Everyone has something akin to a social security number. Everyone who was domiciled in the most affected areas was reached out through their social security numbers. They were issued something like proper bank cards or ATM cards, and that money went straight into their accounts. They may have been potentially small amounts of leakages, but there were no reports of large-scale misuse of funds.
Aisha Siddiqui teaches in the Department of Geography at the University of Cambridge and is the author of In the Wake of Disaster. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
In the English coastal county of Cornwall, Cosmic Girl made a bid for space.
We are wheels off the ground. Godspeed, Launcher One. Godspeed, Cosmic Girl, on this historic both European and UK mission to open space for everyone.
Cosmic Girl is the name of a Boeing 747-400 with a rocket slapped onto the left wing near its underbelly. The mission was called Start Me Up after the Rolling Stones tune. The event was live-streamed as a recording of the Stones' hit echoed across the watch party on the airfield below. Across the side of the aircraft were splashed the red logos of Virgin Orbit. That's the branch of billionaire Richard Branson's business empire that focuses on satellite launches. This was not some mogul having his private space fund. Today's launch was state-run by the UK Space Agency and others. And believe it or not, it marked the first space launch ever for the UK.
Welcome back, everyone. This is sometimes thought of as kind of the more quiet part of our mission. Obviously, we haven't dropped the rocket yet. When we light that candle, things are going to happen very, very quickly.
The candle would be the rocket, and the idea was this. Cosmic Girl, the 747, would launch the rocket mid-flight, and the rocket would fire into orbit with satellites on board. Abruptly, though, the live stream of the launch cut out.
Welcome back, everyone. It appears that Launcher One has suffered an anomaly, which will prevent us from making orbit for this mission.
The rocket crashed. The satellites were lost. They were insured, but the launch staff said they were, as they put it, gutted. As their American friends at the U.S. Space Force once explained...
You know, space is hard.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is a reason we use the phrase, it's not rocket science, to describe something that's not that hard to do, because rocket science is that hard to do. We'll be right back with the next half hour of the show. You're listening to The World. When the pandemic hit, Las Vegas mostly stayed open and could brag about being the global destination for gambling. But now Macau is ready to raise the stakes.
After 3 years of pessimism and doom and gloom, we're seeing some positive, there's good vibes in the air.
A small island off China's southern coast challenges Vegas once again, coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A group of 24 volunteer aid workers are on trial today on the Greek island of Lesbos. They stand accused of espionage and fraud. The group is carrying out rescue operations in the Mediterranean, saving migrants who were trying to make it to Greek soil. Among the defendants is Syrian aid worker Sara Mardini, the inspiration for a recent Netflix film called The Swimmers. Human rights groups say the charges are baseless and politically motivated. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has been following today's events. What can you tell us about what happened in court today, Orla?
Well, lawyers for the defendants, for the 24 aid workers, laid out their opening arguments. They reiterated their view that the charges were baseless, but that also the indictments themselves are really vague. In some cases, the lawyers said there were pages missing, that translations were incorrect, and there were other inconsistencies, and that some of the defendants today have said they don't even know exactly what they're supposed to be charged with. There were four offences mentioned, two of them, as you say, espionage and fraud, and also forgery and sharing state secrets. The lawyers for the aid workers say the charge of espionage and sharing state secrets actually refers to the use of WhatsApp and the way that aid workers used to monitor the radio channels belonging to the Greek Coast Guard to see when migrant boats might be nearby. The aid workers argue that anyone with the VHF radio can access these channels. But the judge this morning said she would consider all of this. She would also consider what the defendant said regarding the indictments and all the confusion around them. And she's scheduled the next session for this coming Friday.
24 people on trial. The most famous probably is Sarah Mardini, the Syrian activist. Was she in the courtroom today?
She wasn't. Mardini was barred from returning to Greece when she was first arrested back in 2018. And she could have appealed the ban, I understand, to appear today, but she decided not to. There were some reports today that she suffers from PTSD from her time in Greek prison in 2018. But just to remind people, Marco, and many of our listeners might remember Mardini because she has spoken here on the show in the past, but she and her sister Yusra saved the lives of 18 other migrants when they themselves were fleeing from Syria in 2015. Both sisters are trained swimmers, and when the boat they were travelling on between Turkey and Greece started to sink, the two sisters jumped into the water and swam, pulling the rubber dinghy with all the migrants on board behind them for 3 hours. And everyone survived the journey, and the sisters themselves ended up in Germany. They've been granted asylum, and Yusra, as you'll remember, went on to compete in the Rio Olympics. And their story was made into a film. But Sarah decided a few years ago to return to Greece and to Lesbos, the place where she and Yusra had arrived as refugees, to try and help other refugees arriving on the Greek shores. And it was there that she was arrested by the authorities.
I mean, it was a life-saving operation, it seems. Human rights groups say the trial is politically motivated. What is their reasoning?
I mean, the Greek government has taken an increasingly hard line against migrants since it came into office in 2019. The Coast Guard itself has been accused repeatedly by NGOs of illegal pushbacks of migrants back towards Turkey. And the Greek authorities claim that these search and rescue missions that Sarah Mardini and others were involved in incurred as people smuggling, something the volunteer groups resolutely deny. And I was talking to Wies de Grava, who was in the courthouse in Lesbos this morning. He's with Amnesty International. And he said that these charges against the aid workers, they're already having an effect on Lesbos.
We see the way this whole thing is approached by the Greek authorities as an attempt to deter humanitarians from helping others, and of course also sending a discouraging message to people who would flee to Europe to find security. There are no rescue missions right now in the Aegean Sea, or at least not on Lesbos. So yes, I am afraid that chilling effect is really deterring people to help other people, which is a very dramatic thing in my view.
And the Greek authorities might be hoping that, you know, not having volunteers there to help migrants arrive on boats will deter the migrants from arriving. But the NGOs say that nothing, you know, that doesn't stop migrants from making these dangerous journeys in the first place.
Orla, you mentioned earlier that the trial is going to continue on Friday. Do we have any sense of what might happen then?
We don't really. We know the judge said she'd consider the complaints this morning by the defendants regarding the indictments being confusing and incomplete, etc. Some in the court were saying today that they hope she might throw out the case altogether. But the problem is this, Marco, these aren't the only charges the 24 are facing. These are actually considered minor charges. The Greek authorities have also charged them with more serious felonies of people smuggling and money laundering, and the investigation into those charges is still underway. They haven't even reached trial yet. So even if this case is thrown out on Friday, or is won in the weeks to come, the defendants will still have to face more serious charges down the road, which could carry prison terms of up to 20 years.
The World's Orla Barry speaking with me about the trial of aid workers who helped migrants land in Greece and now stand accused of espionage. Orla, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Bullfighting, it's on the decline worldwide as views about animal rights are evolving. It's now only legal in 7 countries. In Colombia, the Senate there recently voted to ban bullfights, bringing the country closer to making them fully illegal. It's been divisive. Some Colombians see bullfighting as torture. Others call it culture and art. Reporter Manuel Rueda has more from a recent bullfighting festival in the city of Manizales.
A crowd of almost 15,000 people fills the bullfighting ring in Manizales to watch matador Antonio Ferreira taunt a 990-pound bull. As a brass band plays in the stance, the injured beast charges at the matador's red cape. It runs around Ferreira's waist, its horns just inches away from the bullfighter's body. When Ferreira draws his sword and points it at the tired bull, the crowd goes silent. Until he kills the animal, by driving his blade into the back of its neck. Animal rights activists say this is torture. In places like Barcelona, Mexico City, and Bogotá, they have convinced local governments to ban bullfights, or make conditions to hold them so complicated that promoters are no longer interested in staging the events. But in Manizales, which is a smaller and more conservative city, bullfights are a big part of the local culture. Fans from all over Colombia visit the town in January for its annual bullfighting festival, which features some of the top matadors from Spain, France, Colombia, and Peru. Darío Villegas is here with his wife and their 23-year-old daughter.
Entonces venimos a Manizales a eso, a deleitarnos con esta fiesta aquí porque es la única que queda buena en Colombia.
This is the last major festival in Colombia, he says. There might come a moment when this is banned altogether, even in Spain. So we have to enjoy it while it lasts. In December, Colombia's Senate voted on a bill that bans bullfights nationwide. It still needs to be approved by the House of Representatives, where it has a 50-50 chance of passing. But after decades of protests, this is the closest the country has ever come to banning this tradition. Terry Hurtado is a city council member from Cali, who has led efforts to ban bullfighting in Colombia.
We think the consciousness that is linked to bullfights is a type of consciousness that comes from the past and has made a lot of damage to humankind, to Earth. And that anthropocentric way of mindset is something that has to be shifted to another kind of mindset.
He's at a parade in Manizales that's held the same week as the bullfights and mostly features marching bands and beauty queens. But the animal rights activists are also allowed to participate. As a group of activists walk down the city's main avenue with their anti-bullfighting posters, some spectators heckle them. Others applaud them and take selfies with the group's mascot, a man dressed as a smiling bull. I think what they do with the bulls is terrible, says Maria Clemencia Rodriguez, who's watching the parade. They injure them before killing them. I hope this tradition ends. Supporters of bullfights say that the animals they use are bred precisely for the purpose of fighting in arenas, and spend their lives in free-range pastures, where they're better off than millions of cows that are used for beef. Luz Marina Salazar is a season ticket holder. We're not forcing people to go to bullfights, she says. We just want our freedoms and our traditions to be respected. In Manizales, bullfighting also attracts thousands of tourists who spend money on hotels and restaurants. The local chapter of the Red Cross owns the bullfighting ring, and profits from January's bullfighting festival are donated to the Children's Hospital. Sergio Sat is 22 and has been a student at the local bullfighting school since he was 17. He's already killed a 700-pound bull and says that a bullfighting ban would jeopardize his future as a matador. This is a difficult time for us, he says, but it's the perfect time to show that we're united and to fight against politicians who are only opposing us because they want to get votes. The next few months will be decisive for young bullfighters and animal rights activists alike. This tradition may not be as popular as it was decades ago, but its dedicated fans and promoters say that they will defend it until their last breath. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Manizales, Colombia.
Things could have gone much worse on the border between Serbia and Kosovo. Last month, ethnic Serbs set up barricades blocking cross-border traffic between the two countries. That ratcheted up nerves and put security forces on alert. In the end, though, diplomacy prevailed, things calmed down, and the barricades were taken down. The tension, though, between Serbia and Kosovo has not disappeared. As Rebecca Collard reports, there's worry that Russia is trying to stoke the long-running conflict.
In his end-of-year address, the president of Serbia, Aleksandar Vučić, talked about his government's achievements and described himself as a wolf that cannot be tamed by international pressure. He called the European Union's attempts to make Serbia join sanctions against Russia brutal interference in his country's affairs. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, President Vučić has tried to pull off a complicated balancing act between the West, which holds the keys to Serbia's long-sought EU membership, and Russia, a country with which Serbia has historic political and cultural ties. Some worry that is giving Russia an opportunity to stoke tensions in the Balkans and distract from its war in Ukraine. Anđelos Marina is a senior policy fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. She says Vučić is walking a fine line.
He has probably put himself into such a situation that we, by constantly trying to play both sides, sometimes even against one another, and I mean the West versus Russia, he has, you know, he has kind of dug himself so deep that he can't just turn around and say, we are not listening to whatever Russia has to say.
Last month, ethnic Serbs in northern Kosovo blocked roads and flew Serbia's national flag. An estimated 50,000 ethnic Serbs live in the northern part of Kosovo, near the Serbian border. Serbia has never recognized Kosovo's independence, declared in 2008, with the support of the West. The barricades came down after a few weeks, but tensions remain high, and Russia is accused of trying to exploit that. In an interview with Deutsche Welle, Kosovo's Prime Minister Albin Kurti called Serbia a client regime of Russia, pointing to joint military exercises and weapons Moscow supplies to Belgrade.
It is not only about software of tensions, it's about the hardware of tensions, and that has to do very much with Serbia getting equipped from Russian Federation.
Moscow has been seeking influence in the Balkans for centuries, first positioning itself as a patron of the Orthodox Christians against the Islamic Ottoman Empire, more recently with diplomatic support, blocking war crimes tribunals for Serbs and stopping UN membership for Kosovo. Anđelos Marina says Russia is also using the most modern of tactics.
In roundabout ways, like they would probably influence disinformation campaigns, which has been happening a lot.
As tensions peaked in northern Kosovo last month, Russia's state broadcaster aired testimonies of Serbs who said they were raped, tortured, and abused during the Balkans War in the 1990s. But it was the atrocities being committed by Serbian forces that brought NATO military intervention to the region. That conflict ripped open ethnic and religious divides that still have not healed.
Russia has always tried to use different situations in Europe where there is an entry point to create troubles for the EU and for the West, you know, to make NATO, which is a main security provider in Kosovo, seem weak.
Adnan Kermanji is with the European Stability Initiative.
If Russia is going to stoke something in between Serbia and Kosovo, it needs local actors.
Serbia has talked about sending troops to protect ethnic Serbs inside Kosovo. Anđelos Marina says that is not likely to happen. But she says there has been unconfirmed reports of so-called Little Green Men, Russian or Serbian paramilitary forces near the border. And on the political level,
there is, you know, obvious Russia presence in different forms. There is the very active Russian ambassador in Belgrade, who has just recently won some kind of award from the Russian government for pushing Russia policy so well.
Serbia refuses to join sanctions against Russia. It has a free trade agreement with Moscow and gets around 85% of its fuel from Russia. Interrupting that would have a massive impact on Serbia's economy. On the other hand, the EU remains Serbia's biggest trading partner, and EU membership could have massive economic advantages. Kosovo officially applied to join the EU last month, but Serbia has been a candidate for more than a decade. Kermanji says Balkan countries need a clear path to EU membership.
This promise of EU perspective and EU membership is what, to a great extent, kept the peace in the region.
For Serbia, that path is looking less certain than ever. The EU wants Belgrade to get in line with its foreign policy with regard to Russia. And a major condition for Serbia to join the EU is normalizing relations with Kosovo. A poll in the spring showed that for the first time, more Serbs were against EU membership than for it. Perhaps a sign that while Russia has not opened a military front in the Balkans, it has managed to create a divide in the minds of the people. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Berlin.
Indonesia's parliament made headlines last month when it overhauled its colonial-era criminal code. One section that got a lot of attention is the part that criminalizes sex outside of marriage. But advocates say there's much more to be concerned about in these new laws. The world's Bianca Hillier reports.
Anindya Rastuviani is the program director for Jakarta Feminist, an organization working toward gender equality in Indonesia. She says the country's new criminal code has a number of articles that uniquely impact reproductive health issues.
The government is trying to limit who are the people that are lawful in terms of providing information on contraceptive, on any family planning.
The new code restricts anyone other than, quote, authorized officials from sharing guidance on different birth control and abortion methods. The code does not currently define who those authorized officials are.
The government does not provide any education. Most of the time, it's the civil society who are providing this comprehensive education. So we are now having the situation where nobody gets sex ed.
Other vague articles also concern Rastuviani, including the ones which criminalize insulting the president or any government institutions, and another that bans expressing views that go against state ideology. Rastuviani worries the feminist ideology she preaches will be targeted.
In this new article, there is no clear definition what is against the main national ideology, so they can use that to criminalize feminists.
Dede Utomo, a gay activist in Indonesia, has also been carefully reading through the new laws. He says his first reaction to the text was actually relief.
Because the explicit criminalization of homosexual intercourse is not there.
But his solace was short-lived. Utomo grew worried when he read Article 2.
Which talks about whatever is not mentioned in this code can be prosecuted if the behavior is against the living law in the community, meaning the local values. And you know how relative that could be.
In theory, that means any aspect of queer life could be deemed unacceptable by locals and prosecuted. Homosexuality is legal in most of Indonesia, but Utomo points out that advocacy isn't easy.
It's been really bad. We have to operate basically underground.
He says LGBTQ events are either kept secret until the last minute, or organizations use a different, non-controversial event topic as a front. So the new criminal code isn't creating an entirely new reality for queer people. Instead, it's making an already difficult situation much worse.
It's another blow to being queer and being minorities in general. Those who can do so will look for asylum in some more queer-friendly countries, Canada, Australia, New Zealand.
For now, Utomo himself plans to stay in Indonesia. Lawmakers are drafting guidelines for how to implement the new laws. They'll go into effect in 3 years. Until then, both Utomo and Anindya Rastuviani say they will consider all available options to fight back, whether that leads them to the streets or the court. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The island of Macau, not far from Hong Kong, is known for really one attraction, its casinos. For the past 3 years, Macau's card tables have been pretty quiet. But as Chinese travel opens up, Macau is ready to reclaim its throne as the global gambling hotspot. The world's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Las Vegas has nothing on Macau. In a good year, Macau's casinos will rake in 4 to 5 times what the Vegas Strip makes. Easy. And when it comes to atmosphere, Macau prides itself on being a classier destination.
It is designed to attract the premium players, the really super, super high rollers.
Alidad Tash was a strategist at the Venetian Casino in Vegas and the Venetian in Macau. He now runs a Macau-based gaming consultancy called 28.
And to be able to attract those people, you need magnificent facilities, beautiful, ostentatious buildings. That's why the buildings here are just phenomenal.
Macau is extravagant, clean, posh, not really a blackjack and whiskey type of place. Its players prefer baccarat and milk tea. It wasn't always so fancy, though. Macau was once a fishing port. Portugal colonized it in the 1550s and then built casinos in the 1850s. and until 1999, it was still a Portuguese colony. Alidad Tash says back then, Macau was a different place.
It was a little bit on the seedy side. Think about the worst parts of Atlantic City.
But then China took possession of Macau, as it did Hong Kong, and Macau revamped its image, soon putting Vegas's earnings to shame. Not long ago, Macau's casinos were raking in $30, $40, $45 billion in a year. As China grew richer, Macau kept riding a hot streak, one that only a global cataclysm could stop.
Macau now has 7 confirmed cases of the coronavirus. The city is now looking like a ghost town during what is normally one of the busiest times of the year for the casino hub.
That's a Singaporean news broadcast from 2 years ago. During the pandemic, Macau was, at times, totally closed to foreigners. For mainland Chinese, it's been very hard to reach, too, sometimes requiring hotel quarantine and lots of nasal swabs. But serious gamblers still made the trek.
There'd be like 3 guys playing in a casino, and there'd be 30 or 40 staff looking at them. The fantasy kind of wore off, and you were constantly reminded you're being watched.
Tash says casino execs knew the atmosphere was terrible. So why didn't Macau's casinos just shut down? Well, in a sense, they couldn't. Macau has a mix of Chinese-run and U.S.-branded casinos. And as the pandemic raged, Tash says that Beijing essentially gave these big employers an ultimatum.
You want any action? You have to basically play by our rules. And our rules are the Macau locals, which comprise, I guess, something like around 90% of the staff, maybe even higher, cannot be fired, cannot be laid off.
Tash says any Macau casino that fired a bunch of locals would risk losing its license. So they had to stay open and lose money. This is how Las Vegas was able to take back the throne. Throughout the pandemic, the Vegas Strip only closed for a couple months. True to its libertine spirit, it has mostly stayed wide open. In 2022, Vegas casinos made close to $8 billion, breaking records, while Macau brought in a measly $5 billion. But Tash says Vegas won't retain the title world's most profitable casino town for very long.
After 3 years of pessimism and doom and gloom, we're seeing some good vibes in the air.
Starting this week, visitors can roll right into Macau if they show a negative COVID test, thanks to Chinese leader Xi Jinping ditching his hardline zero COVID rules. Macau's casinos are eager for guests, having lost tons of money paying workers and keeping the lights on for 3 years. Tash says don't feel too sorry for them, though. He says Macau will probably recoup its pandemic losses by 2025. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and as always, thanks for listening.